Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Epic Phelan, the Epic Phelan podcast. Today, we have with us Lindsay Recknell from Mental Health in Minutes. She's going to be talking about mental health and what she does for a career. And Lindsay, welcome to Epic Phelan.
Hey, Ryan, thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. And thank you for being a guest on my show. I think this is a very important subject. I don't think that I really have had a huge challenge with mental health. I might be wrong on that, but I think that I maybe just haven't seen it as much as other people have or acknowledged it as much as other people have. I know at one point I probably was experiencing seasonal depression, and that was like years ago when I was sort of in a basement suite kind of setting. And I was like, man, I am down. Like, and I'm a pretty positive person, but I was like, I was really feeling it. So I do identify with it at that level, but maybe I wouldn't venture to say as much as other people have to deal with it. And I do see it as a real thing. And I think as I ramble here, guys can tend to be, you know, put things off and, oh no, you know, boo-hoo, you're feeling sad, buck up, right?
Yes, I hear that a lot. I absolutely hear that a lot. And it's actually interesting what you say there about not recognizing it, because I think that's part of the problem to date. You know, we haven't been talking about it often enough. We haven't been using the right language and things like that for people to even recognize or think about that the way they're feeling doesn't have to be that way, that the way that they're feeling is different or not quite like them. And then to have enough sort of self-awareness to say, yeah, you know what, I can do something about this, or I need to get some help, or I need to talk to somebody, whatever that looks like. I think it's really important to call out.
So the first step, I guess would be recognizing it. But when you don't know what to look for, how do you recognize it?
Yeah. So I first actually want to say that there is a difference between mental health and mental illness. You can think about mental health as that kind of overall umbrella, sort of synonymous with mental wellness. It's on a spectrum. It's a scale from, you know, awesome mental health, awesome mental wellness, to not so awesome mental health or not so awesome mental wellness. You can feel on both ends of those scale at any time. And it is kind of a journey. You move along that scale as circumstances happen, as seasons happen, like you mentioned, as other people's emotions start to affect you, any of those kinds of things, you can move along that scale. Mental illness is within mental health. And mental illness means that you've been diagnosed with a mental illness, depression, anxiety, OCD, bipolar, all of these kind of words that we've heard or are familiar with, they get diagnosed according to, I'm going to get a bit technical here, it's called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, and there's lists of symptoms that your doctor, your psychiatrist would use to diagnose an actual mental illness. That is different than your mental health. You can feel mentally well with a mental illness, the same way that you can feel mentally not well with a mental illness. So I think it's just important that we talk about how they're not the same thing, and you can experience excellent mental health even if you have a diagnosable mental illness.
That makes actually a lot more sense than what I thought I was going to originally. I mean, I guess you could look at it like general health. You can have a underlying condition, or you could have a genetic condition maybe that, but you could still be healthy, right?
Yeah.
Like you could have, yeah, like a heart, you could have diabetes, but still be, I'm a totally healthy person, right? There's healthy people that have, yeah.
That's a great analogy or a great comparison, because that's the thing about mental health is we haven't talked about it enough for it to be as normalized part of a conversation as talking about our physical wellness. To say that you have diabetes, kind of no big deal. You know, nobody stigmatizes you around it. Nobody looks at you differently. But if you say that you suffer from bipolar, all of a sudden people get scared. Maybe they're fearful of you because they don't understand. And I think it's so important to have conversations like this so we can normalize that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So people don't look at you as like the ticking time bomb, or there is definitely that stigma behind, you know, bipolar, especially, or, you know, different conditions. Absolutely.
That is my mission with my business, which is called Mental Health in Minutes. It is meant to help people and organizations to normalize these kinds of conversations, to give people the language, to give people the opportunity for curiosity, to ask questions in a safe space, in a non-judgmental place, to, you know, explore what it means to have mental illness or to be mentally well and that kind of thing. We don't know what we don't know, right? We don't know the difference between mental health and mental illness unless somebody tells us. And so that's why I think the work that we're doing with Mental Health in Minutes is changing the game a bit. It's changing the organization and changing cultures to be able to have more of these kinds of conversations in a normalized way.
Bringing it to light is the best thing to do. I think we've been doing, you know, especially recently, a good job of that, to have open and honest conversations about it. And it's not as stigmatized as before. But I think there are still some challenges with that, where, you know, even within my own circle, sometimes I can be my own hardest critic and be like, ah, you know, get over it, Ryan, you're being a baby, you know, like, or, you know, kind of things like that. Right. Like, and it's like, but no, like some of these things, you know, you should address in your mental health and just, you know, your overall feelings. Not like you should be walking around with a giant smile on your face, like all the time, but to not beat yourself up or whatever. I mean, is that sort of what we're looking at?
Yeah, that self-forgiveness. If it matters to you, it matters. So often we think, well, you know, it's not such a big deal. How I'm feeling is, you know, not as bad as somebody else. There's starving children in Africa and people living in war-torn countries. And you're right. Those things are horrible and terrible, and they're absolutely happening. But it doesn't diminish how you are feeling about whatever it is that's going on for you today. If it matters to you, it 100% matters. And you get to go through that journey and you get to figure it out and you get to feel it and all of those things. And that self-forgiveness and that patience with yourself as you continue along that journey of recovery, whatever that looks like for you, it's valid and it matters and it's important and you get to go through it.
Absolutely. So it's great what you do, but who's your ideal person that you would be talking to in order to get your message out and to be able to provide a service for them, and what might the service be?
So I want to help all the humans. I know that so general, but honestly, if you and I can continue to have these conversations, if I can have conversations with leaders in organizations that can make a positive impact on the employees within their organizations, if I can speak to parents, if I can speak to teenagers, anyone who needs to hear the message that it's okay to have these kinds of conversations. And not only is it okay to have these conversations, but if I can help people know what to say, how to open the door to those conversations, those are the people I want to talk to. Because so often we need to ask for help when we're struggling, right? If there's something that's been done really well in the last few years, it's we recognize to ask for help when we need it. But what the heck does a person say when they're asking for help?
Like, I have no idea. I am the worst person to ask for this. I'll admit it. And I would say it's probably my biggest fault, where I may even at times take too much on, but asking for help, even on a basic level, I am the worst. It's like a control freak kind of thing. I don't know if it has anything to do with society or the way things are, the way, you know, it's like, handle your own stuff. And, you know, maybe I'm just a control freak, but that's the hardest, admittedly, the hardest thing that I have to do is ask for any kind of help anywhere.
And you are absolutely not the only one. In fact, I can't think of anyone that doesn't struggle with asking for help, because often we don't even know what to say, right? So think about, you're with your buddies and you recognize that one of your buddies doesn't really seem like himself. Maybe he's just not as talkative or not as energetic. And you say to him, hey, is something going on? Can I help? And he goes, no, I'm good. I'm totally fine. Because the alternative is for him to say, you know what, Ryan, I'm really feeling sad today. Like, how awkward is that? You know, you're with a whole bunch of people and that could be totally awkward for him. So what do you say? So that's some of the work that I do, is teach people options, give them conversation starters to open the doors to those kinds of conversations. In one of my workshops, we talk about creating an environment so people feel comfortable having those conversations. You know, in an organization that says, I have an open door policy. You come and talk to me anytime. And then their physical door is always closed or their calendar is always blocked. You know, how does that behavior align with the talk? It absolutely doesn't. So we talk about how to create, you know, the physical environment to have those kinds of conversations. We talk about what to say if the time is not now to have those conversations. So if you're out with your buddies, you recognize your buddy's not doing so hot and you say, hey, is there something I can do to help? He could say to you, you know what, Ryan, I so appreciate you noticing. Can we go out back and let's have a quick conversation? Or, hey, this isn't the time and place, but I'd love to connect with you. I'm going to give you a call in the morning. What time's good for you? Just giving those kinds of scripts, honestly, giving those kinds of prompts so that people know what words they can use when they're in those different situations that might make it a bit easier to have those conversations.
And you're absolutely right, because what somebody might say to you, or what even I might say to somebody if they were to approach me in a group situation, you know, if we're in front of a whole whack of people and say, hey, Ryan, do you need a hand with XYZ? My answer might be very different than a personal touch, like a personal outreach where somebody might say, hey, Ryan, you know, you seem to be struggling with this, or, you know, like, or even like, you just don't seem like yourself. Is everything okay? One-on-one, my answer might be very, very different.
And you would expect it to be very, very different, because often we have those kind of important conversations. We tend to have them in private or one-on-one.
Yeah. Well, it's a defense mechanism, which is, I think it's nature, right? You don't want to show any weakness to anybody. But yeah, no, it's a lot easier one-on-one than in a group setting.
But I also think it's really important that if you are in a group setting and you notice that one of your friends isn't doing so hot, that you don't wait. Don't wait to mention it to him. Take him aside, speak quietly to him in a private way or whatever, but don't wait. You know, you don't know what's going on in your friend's mind. And even if you just give an indication that you noticed, you're conscious and you're there for them. And, you know, when they're ready to talk, they'll talk. Don't wait. You don't know what could come next.
Again, going back to you helping all humans, which is tough. I mean, so are you looking at like primarily going and talking to like the HR department of companies, or are you separate from something like that?
Yeah. So I have two sides of my business. I have a organizational development to normalize mental health conversations. And then I also have a personal empowerment side of my business, which I call Expert in Hope. So to stick with the workplace mental health stuff for a minute, you're right. I speak to HR leaders who kind of control the mental health programming in their organization, whether they are brand new and they're looking for content to create a program. I have content for them to create a program, or they are looking for kind of a mental health maintenance program. So they've already done maybe a big bang implementation, and now they want to continue that learning. You know, they've done a day-long workshop and everybody's pumped and fired up and excited to implement, and then nothing after that. And so I work with organizations to keep the learning going. My Mental Health in Minutes subscription provides the content for leaders to deliver to their people. So the leaders don't have to do the research. They don't have to do the content creation. They don't have to create the presentations or the materials. I provide them all of that on whatever topic it is that'll help their organization the best. And then they get to connect and deliver that, those materials, those presentations to their people. So I connect with HR leaders, functional leaders also that kind of control their own budget. Often functional leaders are waiting for HR or senior leadership to do something and it's not happening fast enough. So I speak to functional leaders that just want to get it done and start supporting their people right away and kind of create a grassroots movement. So that seems to work really well. And then lately I've had the opportunity to speak to health and safety professionals in organizations as well. psychological health and safety is coming into law. Occupational health and safety, which is physical health and safety, is already law. Organizations have standards they have to follow for our physical safety, but we do not yet have laws that we need to follow for our psychological safety. But it's coming. There's a Canadian standard of psychological safety that I am a certified advisor to implement in organizations. And smart organizations are getting ahead of the curve to implement the standard, the psychological health and safety standard, ahead of the law so that they're already set up by the time that happens.
And that's awesome that it's being brought to light in that sense, even because the question that I had coming up was almost a really jerky kind of question. But, you know, if I was to play devil's advocate to a business that maybe didn't value or see the value in the mental health of its employees or didn't think that this was a thing, you know, what would you have to say to that? Someone that would say, you know, so what, my employees are sad, you know, get a, you know, right? You know, the whole, again, going back to this whole, like, get over it, you know, get to work, do your job, right? How does what you do kind of translate into maybe increased performance or even just a better workplace? Maybe it's a retention within its organization.
Yeah, you would probably be not surprised to hear that this is the number one conversation I have with senior leaders. Unfortunately and sadly, it is the conversation that I have with senior leaders. How is this work? How is increasing the wellness of my employees going to help my bottom line? How is this not just a checkbox activity? So I have done a lot of research and I have a lot of statistics to back up the importance and the absolute return on investment for doing this work in your organization. So you mentioned retention. That's a huge thing. If your employees feel valued, if they feel like the work they're doing is contributing to the overall vision and mission for the company, if they are feeling like their leader is connected to them, that their workload is, if not balanced, at least integrated with their life, those guys are going to stick around, right? They say that it costs you 2.5 times an employee's salary to do new recruitment. So if you can save an employee from leaving your organization, you've already saved yourself 2.5 times the cost of that new employee. So there's one. Secondly, if you are increasing wellness in your organization, your benefits utilization rates are going to go down. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, when you get your employee benefits package, when an organization negotiates that with the providers, there's your standard health and dental and those kinds of things. But there's also what they call paramedical, often for psychologists or counselors. There's also employee family assistance programs. And that stuff is awesome. And it's totally there when you need it, even there proactively, so that you can feel well before you get to, you know, a drastic bottom or before you get totally burnt out. But for an organization, it's expensive. Offering employee benefits is not an inexpensive cost to an organization. And they pay based on how much you use the system. So if we can support our employees' wellness proactively, continuing to build those relationships in a really positive way, they won't have to use their benefits because they're burnt out or because their physical health is suffering from the stressors in their job. So from a dollars and cents point of view, if we improve the wellness of our employees, they won't use their benefits, which means you won't be charged for their usage. Again, in black and white, sort of ugly discussion, but that is one of the benefits of doing this kind of work if your senior leaders are concerned about the ROI.
I think that's probably the best way to put it is just, yeah, the retention one was something that really hit me where I didn't know, like, yeah, 2.5 times to train a new employee than it is to keep one.
You've got productivity to consider. There's absenteeism. So if you lower your absenteeism rates, assuming you're going to get more productivity out of your people, as long as they are also not suffering from what we call presenteeism. So being there in body, but not in spirit, you know, you can sit your bum in your seat, but if you're not engaged and you're probably surfing Facebook all day, how much work are you actually getting done? right? If you can engage your people, their productivity rates are going to go up. You're going to get more out of them and your company's going to increase. So, you know, you're going to get less people calling in sick, even if they're not sick, and you're going to get more people that are engaged and actually doing the work when they're at their job, if you can make them recognize how valuable and important they are to you and your organization.
Absolutely. And I mean, maybe something that might be a hidden benefit. I mean, what about the senior management or owners of a company that might look at, you mentioned burnout before, or you know, just the stresses of running a business, and you know, sure, getting this for their employees might be good, but is, you know, is there an element in there to help them, to help the owners of the business, or to help the senior management or president, CEO kind of idea?
I think that is so important to talk about, Ryan. Thank you for that. Because so often we talk about how leaders have to do this for other people and leaders have to show up in this way for other people. And can we just talk about how exhausting that is? It's already exhausting for them to be, you know, present and trying to do their work and run their companies and motivate their people, let alone add the extra stuff of already being human and struggling with their own burnout and their own mental wellness and all of those things. You're totally right. And we underestimate, we don't support our leaders as much as we could be with a lot of the programming. And it is something that we've really focused on within Mental Health in Minutes, because it's not leadership training. It's not employee training. It's human being training. It's customized. It's intended to be a conversation between all of the people on the team, so that regardless of what level you're at, regardless of what role you're in, you are going to get something out of learning, because it's not targeted to somebody in a leadership role or somebody on the front line. It is truly customized to whomever is in the room, and you'll get something out of it because you're in the room.
I really like that. That's awesome. Yeah, because I find people in leadership roles too can often be overwhelmed or burnt out, but the focus is always both positive and negative. Positively looking, okay, how do I help my people? Or my people just never get it right, and they're always, you know, never, they're never listening to me. They're never doing what I tell them to do, and whatnot. And it's to open that up, to give that those people in the leadership roles a bit of a hand when it comes to their mental health.
Yeah, there's so many expectations on leaders. And especially, I hate to say it, but over the last 15 months, the expectations on leaders are even higher than they've ever been, if that's ever possible. That's why I'm really proud of what we've built within Mental Health in Minutes, because it doesn't discriminate against or for anyone in a particular position within an organization. It is absolutely going to benefit you because you are a human being in the room.
So if somebody wanted to, maybe a CEO wanted to reach out to you for Mental Health in Minutes, what, I mean, I know we have a whole nother side of this to talk about too, but if somebody wanted to reach out to you just while we're at it, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah. So I am everywhere at mentalhealthinminutes.com. So my website is the easiest way to find us. You can check out the subscription options there. You can check out the two live webinars that I do on burnout and then on boundaries, which is one of the strategies for stopping the slide into burnout. You can learn more about our methodology and how we create the materials using, you know, adult learning techniques and the research within positive psychology and psychological health and safety and all that good stuff. I'm very active on LinkedIn, so you can find me there as well. And I absolutely want to have a conversation with anyone who values mental wellness for themselves or for their people.
Nice. Now, hope. Let's talk about hope. What can you tell me about hope, Lindsay?
See, Ryan, I think hope has a PR problem, because when we talk about the word hope, I bet you think I'm going to talk about God and fluffy stuff and cosmic woo-woo, because often that's what we have experienced. We know that hope is that kind of bubbly, anticipatory, excited feeling in our belly. But did you know that it's an actual science? And there's over 2,000 research studies to support its power in transforming our lives not to be dramatic, but truly transforming our lives.
Now, okay. I am also a skeptic. I do see where you're going, but I mean, I'm going to again play the jerk role and be like, so are we talking like the secret kind of thing? Or?
No, we are talking brain science.
So real science, that's good. I like that.
For real science, the real science is called positive psychology. So positive psychology is the opposite of traditional psychology. Traditional psychology is the study of decreasing sadness, so going from negative to neutral. Positive psychology is about going from neutral to positive, so increasing wellness, leading to human flourishing. Positive psychology was founded back in the late 80s, early 90s by a scientist called Dr. Martin Seligman, who at the time was the president of the American Psychology Association, APA. And when he was president, he, of course, as any good president does, wants to make his mark on his profession, or he wanted to make his mark on his profession during his tenure. And previous to his presidency, he had been working on this theory of positive psychology and actually started with a theory called learned helplessness. Learned helplessness was all about, he hypothesized that we could learn to be helpless. He did studies with dogs, not cool, but it did lead to some pretty important science as he continued on. So once he had this big platform as president of the APA, the science really took off. So positive psychology was started at the University of Pennsylvania, and there are a huge number of researchers that are now studying wellness, studying human flourishing, studying how our brain works when we are focused on the future, when we are actively engaged in working towards our goals and finding flow in our day and all this kind of thing. So I was particularly interested when I learned of this science, because like you, I'm a natural skeptic. I need data. I need analytics. So I found positive psychology and felt super validated, because I knew that when on my days that I was not feeling awesome about myself, or was feeling down, or that I had lost my sort of zest for the future, I knew that there was things I could do to feel better, actions I could take to continue to progress towards whatever goals I was looking for. And positive psychology has a field of science within it called the science of hope. And that is what I've spent the last 4 years focusing my personal empowerment business on, is helping people to leverage the power of hope to transform their life.
What I really like about this is, and I hope it's not read as controversial, and oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying it. So there's a lot of stuff going around, you know, and I think there's a bit of a victimhood mentality across the board. Right. Where, and I don't know if it's from, it's like, everybody likes the come up in story, right? Where it's like, you know, I came from nothing and I did this and I did that. But I think sometimes what it can do, like you were mentioning before, that learned hopelessness, be like, well, you know, I'm painting, I have a learning disability, so I'm never going to make it. Right. Or I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I said, you know, you look at these people that maybe have grown up with what you presume might be some huge amount of luck to be the child of Wayne Gretzky or Michael Jordan or whatnot. You can assume there's a certain amount of privilege absolutely that goes along with those, you know, being a child of somebody of such stature, but all your life you're going to be presented with, yeah, but you're never going to be your father, right? Or you're never going to be your mother, right? Like, yeah, if your mother was a great writer, or even like Ronda Rousey, right? And if, right, like, it's like, how do you grow up in the shadow of somebody that has made such great strides? And so it's, I think everybody has their own little battle to deal with, and you can either take a look at that challenge or that these things that you have, and you can either choose to let them hold you back, or you can use them to push you forward. I know what I'm saying is like probably the most controversial that I've been on my show, and I'll probably have some people say, you have no idea what you're talking about, and but it's like
well, but you're absolutely right. I mean, we all have circumstances that have shaped our lives, and more often than not, we don't know anybody else's stuff, right? We don't know what they've come from. We don't know what challenges are in the way for them. But that's why I teach this stuff, because so my definition of hope, which is different from other people's definition, but through my work, I've come up with this definition that the future will be better than today by taking action over the things we can control. The important words there are future, action, and control. Because if you're Michael Jordan's kid, you can't control that. That is outside your control. You were born into that family. That's outside your control. But there is a crap ton you can control. You can control your actions and what you do with that privilege. You get to control what you learn, who you hang out with. You get to control all of those things. And you can take the actions toward a future better than today for you based on what you can control. That cannot be underrated. Because hope without action is just a wish. That's the difference here. You cannot get to your future, a future better than today, without taking action to get there. Just like you can't win the lotto if you don't buy a damn ticket, right? You can only wish to win the lotto. You can only hope to win the lotto if you buy a ticket, right? Taking that action.
Something, and maybe this is going too deep for this episode because we don't have a whole lot of time left, but what do you hope for? Right. And that's, I think sometimes that can be a struggle in itself too. It's like where, you know, I guess you hope for, you know, a better career. I mean, it could be, I guess, anything, but I think the challenge is just in itself. What do you hope for? Is it that you get a promotion? Is it that you're happy? Right. Are there exercises in that as well?
Oh yes. So you get to choose. You get to choose what's important to you. If it matters to you, it matters. And nobody else gets to judge that. They will, but they don't get to. One of the really cool activities that I do within my work in Hope is called Bucket List Builder. And it is an experience based on a book, because I read a lot. So the book is called The Dream Manager by Matthew Kelly. And it's a business fable where somebody asks the leader in an organization, what are your dreams? And that's the first time he can remember anybody, A, caring enough to ask, but B, anybody asking him what his dreams are. And so I really took that book to heart. I have read it a gajillion times because I just take so much inspiration from it. And Bucket List Builder is something that was created out of that. It can be a virtual experience. Like on my website, you can just go and buy it. And it's two videos and a homework activity and some reflection. But the biggest part is the homework activity. It's the most awful and most awesome part of the whole experience. You literally sit down and with some prompts from me, you create your bucket list. And it's really cool to see what comes out of it when you are dreaming with no limits. Part of the experience is to take away the boundaries, take away the financial obligations, take away other people's expectations. You just get to write down what's important to you and what you want to be, see, do, or have. And then you come up with this cool list of things to do. And you can stop there. You can have this list. You can think about it. You can dream about it. You can, you know, just kind of have it. Or it translates into action, because I'm all about action, into my Dream Catalyst program, which takes Bucket List Builder as your catalyst towards actually achieving some of these things that you'd like to achieve. Because often one of the challenges is we don't know our dreams, but then once we do, what do we do with that? Lots of times it seems overwhelming. We don't know where to start, any of that. And Dream Catalyst will take you along that path and help you to start accomplishing some of that stuff.
Does it almost like help you reverse engineer?
1,000%. Absolutely. So Dream Catalyst is 12 weeks, 90 days. It teaches you how to create a roadmap, how to create alphabet soup to figure out what it is you need to do to get to where you need to go. We actually start with that end in mind. We start with where we're going And then we figure out where we are, because you don't know how to get where you're going if you don't first know where you're at.
That is awesome. And this is all available online.
All available online. My website is expertinhope.com. And that's where you will get your personal empowerment, all powered by the science of positive psychology.
That's Expert in Hope. Who should check out Expert in Hope?
All the humans, obviously.
All the humans. I knew it. I was actually expecting that answer. And that's why I asked it. Is because I think a lot of us, and again, my wide range of friends, I know some people that, you know, as I'm hearing this, I'm like, this would be perfect for this person. But I'm also like, I want to do this. And I think even people that I know that are like the most grounded people I know, I think they should do this just as a cool exercise. I mean, we do all sorts of weird little things every day that seemingly have no effect on us, or maybe even a negative effect on us. But to invest a little bit of time and money, I guess, into something that is going to be fun and something that's going to really be able to help you.
The experience of creating your bucket list through this process can be terrifying. Absolutely. I think that everybody should do this experience, even though it feels hard. One of my friends who kind of did it, the thing that blocked him, the mindset that blocked him, is he thought, well, once I have this stuff written down, she's going to expect me to do something with it. And so he just didn't do it so that he didn't have that expectation on himself, or feel like I had an expectation on him to do something.
What I was going to say is, like, even worse than you maybe seeing it and him not accomplishing it, is that if he goes and writes these things down or creates this list and then he doesn't accomplish it, what is he then, like, he's letting himself down, which is probably the hardest thing to do. Is, and so I think sometimes what we can do is we can put our head in the sand and just say, hey, if I don't acknowledge my dreams or some of my goals, then if I don't achieve them, I've never really put them out there to the universe, so I'm not a failure.
Ignorance is bliss. Totally. Creating your bucket list, you create 100 things on this list. There is no way in hell in your entire lifetime you're going to accomplish 100 things. But that's not the point. The point is to get them out there, to dream about them, to make yourself feel good about them, to spark those synapses in your brain that create joyful chemicals that helps you to continue to move forward. The benefit of creating the list isn't only to do the things on the list. It's actually bigger than that. It's actually what your brain needs to continue with that hope, to continue motivating you towards a future better than today. So just really briefly, I mentioned brain science. Let me tell you how your brain works on hope, okay? So I call it the hope circuit. It's the limbic system in your brain. Three parts. Starts with the hippocampus, which you can remember like your elephant in your brain, because an elephant never forgets. The hippocampus is where memories are made, whether they are real memories or memories that happen while you're dreaming, while you're creating your bucket list, as an example. Your brain can't really distinguish between the two. So it is creating those memories in your hippocampus. Once those memories are there, either dreams or reality, those memories move into the next part of the limbic system, the next part of the hope circuit, which is your amygdala. And the amygdala is like your guard dog. It's responsible for fight, flight, or freeze. It is there to protect you. It wants to help you decide what's going to be good for you and what's not going to be good for you. This is where your fear happens, because once you've created that bucket list, as an example, this is what happens next if you are now terrified of expectations, or what if you do accomplish them, or what will people think? All of that happens in your guard dog, in the amygdala part of your brain. Once you've figured out what is good for you and what you want to do, which of these memories you want to action, it moves into the third part of your hope circuit, the third part of your limbic system, which is the prefrontal cortex, the PFC, which can also be remembered as your wise old owl. This is your command center. This is where all the actions are taken, all the prioritization happens. It's your owl, your PFC, that says, what am I going to do next to get me closer to that future better than today? So if you don't create those memories, if you don't create that bucket list, how can you even continue through your hope circuit towards that future better than today? You can't. You need those memories, dreams, and reality to continue to increase your hope. Hope is absolutely learned, and it absolutely is progressive and will continue with that kind of intention.
That's amazing. What I was just sitting here thinking is that I had no idea how this whole episode was going to go, but it's definitely went off in a bit of a different direction. And I love the direction it went off in too. It's like, where again, we're talking about goals and achieving your goals and how that, you know, is again, you know, get dopamine from that and how that's just improving your mental health. I find a lot of things that I talk about within the show are reaching your goals and how people have become successful and whatnot. But yeah, that is super, super cool. So we've had the whole spectrum of dealing with mental health and the difference between mental health and mental illness and the stigma behind that towards, you know, self-improvement and bettering oneself.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting, huh?
It is super exciting.
Yeah, I could talk about this stuff for hours, clearly. I know that I don't think your episodes are typically this long, but thank you for letting me talk about it as much as I can, because I really think, I mean, it is my mission in life to solve hope's PR problem. More people need to know how hope works in our brain and how we can truly create transformation within our lives and in our organizations by focusing on this stuff. And it's not complicated. It doesn't have to be hard. It gets to be just small actions starting whenever you're going to start. It gets to be that kind of progression that will truly lead to a future better than today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the whole idea of lists. So bucket lists and everything. I love that because that's it's nothing better than checking off an item on your list.
Yes, agreed. I can give you the link to Bucket List Builder so you can put it in the show notes if you'd like.
That would be great if we could get the link for that. And if we get both your websites for those that have an organization or a business, you don't need a HR person or human resources person, probably, right? You probably just need somebody that actually wants to improve the mental health of themselves and their employees.
You got it. Let's improve mental wellness across the board.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Lindsay. And you know what? You'll have to be one of my returning guests because, yeah, I really enjoyed the interview. And I think it's a really good message to get out there. Even just getting the message out, I think, is very important. So, yeah, definitely you'll have to come back.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's been a great discussion.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody that's been listening. And please check out Lindsay Recknell with Mental Health in Minutes and Expert in Hope. Until next time, stay epic.
Thanks again for listening to Epic Phelan. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe, give me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Real Ryan Phelan, and visit my website at thecalgaryrealestateguy.com. Until next time, stay epic.